Blog Talk Radio.
And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Passes a three-strike law and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing innocent people. God damn America.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. My special guest today, Eric Rush, the journalist who broke the Jeremiah Wright story. How many of us can hear that quote without thinking of the 2008 presidential election? Eric is here today because he has just written a very explosive, very controversial new book entitled Negrophilia. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hey, absolutely no problem. I think it's kind of great that you and I sort of knew each other before. We both were thinking along the same lines regarding Hollywood as far as the need to boycott some of these left-wingers, and I think one of your readers actually made you aware of my site where I was trying to organize a boycott against the left-wingers in Hollywood.
Yes, that is true. There's a bit of history there. And that's one of the issues that I, other than race issues that I do address every now and then, having been sort of on the fringes of the entertainment business for some years in my youth, in the music business, and watching culture, you know, I keep my eyes on Hollywood, and so those efforts are ones that I definitely appreciate because they are uniquely involved in the culture war there.
Oh, absolutely. When you speak of the culture war and you talk in Negrophilia about some of the groups that are responsible for perpetuating this mentality of victimization on the part of African Americans, you list the media, liberal white politicians, obviously the liberal schools that we have now, but Hollywood is very much a part of that. But let's start from the beginning and talk about the title of the book. You define it at the beginning of the book, and then you kind of refine it throughout the book. What exactly is Negrophilia?
Well, Negrophilia is not a term that I coined. It's been used on and off, I guess, throughout the 20th century. When people wanted to discuss folks who were enamored with things black, and sometimes it's used in a kind of an off-color way we don't have to go into. But the way, in the context of the book, it describes the aspect of the worldview that has been put forth by the far left for the last few decades that frames black Americans in a certain light, misrepresents them, mischaracterizes them, encourages an inordinate deference to them, while at the same time demonizing whites and advancing the idea that America is still an institutionally racist nation.
You hold out in the book which you consider the best example or proof of Negrophilia that we've seen in recent times, and that is, in fact, the election of Barack Obama. What did Negrophilia have to do with getting Barack Obama elected?
Well, due to the mischaracterization of black Americans by those groups, entities that I mentioned in the book, people had I would say that white America, if you for want of a better term, had a very inaccurate and erroneous viewpoint of Barack Obama. White guilt really runs deep, and I do go into that in depth in the book. And actually, since the book was released, I mean, it's driven itself, you know, that point has really driven itself home even more, the extent of the depth to which white guilt runs. I think that a lot of people, you know, in addition to the establishment press having been completely in the tank for Obama, a lot of people had this idea that, you know, oh, we'll elect this, you know, we'll have our first black president, and He'll have a sense of justice that other people wouldn't because he's black, and he will, you know, be more sensitive to the plight of the underdog, and just a whole host of erroneous perceptions that really are racist in a way, because they characterize black Americans as either not having some of the negative qualities that all human beings possess, or having more of the positive qualities that most human beings possess, and that's just entirely inaccurate. So,
Necrophilia
did, while it was not the sole reason he was elected, it definitely played a big part.
Well, give us some ideas of issues that might have been made more of during the election had Barack Obama not been African American.
Well, geez, where do I start? There was, as I said in 2007, which started this whole thing about Reverend Wright, you know, if a white candidate had been the member of a white equivalent of Trinity United Church of Chicago, people would have been out in the streets with torches and pitchforks looking for Obama and Reverend Wright. You know, or the equivalent thereof, the media would have totally. I mean, his candidacy would have been over within, you know, hours of that news having come out. There was the issue of I know most people aren't aware of it. I talk about the Trinity United murders in. That happened in 2007. There were three gay men who were murdered, and they haven't solved these murders in the from Trinity United Church. These are men who ostensibly Barack Obama knew. There had been gay allegations made against Barack Obama, which were, you know, in his defense, unsubstantiated. One of the men who was murdered was the choir director, who apparently had been frantically trying to contact the Obama team within hours of his murder and was not able to get in touch with them, so to the best of our knowledge. And, you know, you look at something like that and you think, you know, if it were you or I, let alone a prominent person, a senator, someone who might be running for president, they would have been on us like ugly on an ape. Yet, you know, other than a cursory questioning by the Chicago authorities, nothing was ever really made of that. You know, we can go on. I'm not a birther, but the birth certificate issue would have definitely been a bigger one. There was, again, the Larry Sinclair issues, some of the sealing of the school records and the medical records, all sorts of things that people basically demand to know of every candidate that we've ever seen, but not of Barack Obama.
Now, one of the things you point out in your book is that it was during a trip to Hawaii to visit an ailing relative that, and what was it, within a year of the election, about a year before the election, that Barack Obama ordered his birth records sealed. I mean, that seems like highly unusual behavior for a presidential candidate.
Yeah, it definitely is. And let me see if I can recall correctly. It was actually either just before the election or just after the election. It was
okay.
Not. It wasn't, you know, that far out. And which even lends more credence to the argument that, you know, these are things that someone could have been looking into, but just didn't take the, well, other than people like you and I in the alternative media, you know, nobody wanted to even look at it. Now, here's a guy, and now, again, like I said, I'm not a birther. I was not a fly on the wall in the delivery room, so I can't say where he came from. However, this is a guy who, before he ran for president, he and his team and his family were advertising him as having been born in Kenya because they thought that it made him look cool, you know, worldly, international, and so forth. And so you go from being born in Kenya to being born in the United States when it suits your purposes. You go to Kenya, anyone there will tell you, oh, yeah, he was born here. You go to Hawaii, and people kind of laugh into their sleeves as though it's kind of common knowledge there that he wasn't born in the U.S., but what the heck.
Well, now, when you said relatives made reference to him being born in Kenya, are you talking about the Michelle Obama quote where she says, Kenya, that's Barack's home country, and that video is actually available on YouTube, but yet I haven't seen it in the mainstream media?
No, well, I definitely aren't going to see it in the mainstream press, but there are quite a few other examples in the local press in Chicago from when he was running for senator, prior to running for senator, after he became a senator, and you know, I mean, there's just quite enough to raise enough questions that either the Democrat Party, you would have thought, would want to know, and the press should want to know. But once again, it's even a lot of conservative pundits, I suppose, are of the mind that, oh, well, you know, that's been settled. It's not really a big deal. It's been proven that he was born in the United States. And I kind of look at that and I say, it has. You know, I.
That's probably a reference to, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Eric, but I think most of them at that point make a reference to birth announcements that they claim, and I haven't checked this out, actually aired in two Honolulu papers, and they're using that as the proof. They're saying, well, you think this guy was capable of going back and faking newspaper records from, you know, nearly 50 years ago?
Oh, no, but I suppose it's possible that the birth announcements were put in there because his mom and his dad maybe were concerned about what people might make of his citizenship. Maybe they were doing some CYA. I know that the document that has been produced is a joke. I mean, that's something I looked like it came off of my you know, inkjet printer last week.
You're talking about the short form?
Yeah.
And what's ironic about that is that in most of the political positions you could run for in Hawaii, that's not considered valid proof.
No, absolutely not. I mean, he couldn't become a city councilman where I'm from with that.
Wow. Now, I'd like to get back to the Trinity United murders for just a second. You're telling me that there is proof that just before the choir director's murder, he was frantically trying to reach a member of the Obama team. I mean, you're telling me that there are phone records to document this, and the person he was trying to contact was unquestionably a member of Barack Obama's campaign team.
Yes, that is a matter of public record. You can actually find that in it isn't like the New York Times or anything, but you can find that in establishment press outlets. It's kind of just glossed over like, gee, I wonder what the deal was. Maybe somebody was out to get him and he wanted help from his, you know, powerful friend. Other people mm-hmm. postulate that there was a lot of talk going on about, the gay allegations or the bisexual allegations and the drug use and all that stuff, and that there was, Obama was closeted and maybe these people, these gay men, knew something about his past or, you know, perhaps even participated in certain things with him, and they were killed to keep him quiet. You know, now I'm not asserting that, but it's definitely an interesting postulation.
And I think we want to state for the record that, you know, if he happens to be gay or bisexual, who cares? But if it was perceived as a negative, as something that might keep him from being electable, then that would explain the motivation for certain people to get rid of someone who might be able to bring that allegation forth.
Certainly.
It speaks to electability.
Yeah.
Well, I'm actually shocked by this because I have not heard it before, and in reading your book in preparation for this, I saw it for the first time. how was this covered by the mainstream media? Did this ever reach Katie Couric and other anchor desks on the evening news? I mean, how far, I mean, where has this been published? I'm just completely unaware of it.
Well, it didn't reach the desk of any of the national media, to the best of my knowledge. I know that it was in the Chicago press, because what happened was, since all of these men were black, there was, and they were part of the same congregation, which was kind of a happenstance, but there was a concern initially that there in Chicago that there was somebody who might be targeting either gay men, black men, or black gay men to kill them. And so these, the people, you know, the people who were in those groups were really afraid that this might be the start of a serial killing spree. So that was something, that an angle that was looked at by the Chicago press. And then, of course, by the local authorities, obviously, you know, when you have people murdered, they look into that. But then they were looking into the connection that there might be to a, you know, a serial killer type of a circumstance. You know, I don't know where they, the cases are now in terms of opened or closed, but, you know, when it became, when the Obama connection came through, it just was sort of not pursued, other than, you know, Obama's people said, yeah, they were from our church, you know, good luck catching them. And that was it.
Well, now, one of the things I think we should also state, and this is in the book, is that according to the Globe, a police officer in Chicago told them, perhaps, you know, under you know, the condition of anonymity, that the choir director specifically was murdered because of something he knew about Barack Obama. Was he just stating his opinion, or do you think there's more to that?
Well, I know that he said that. I don't know if he was stating his opinion or if he was stating something evidentiary that never came to the forefront. The fact that he didn't say much more than that, you know, and I don't know for what reason, whether it was he was told to shut up or he didn't come, you know, he never came across anything more to support that allegation, you know, is curious. It's the sort of thing that, again, would have made for a media firestorm had it been any other candidate, in my view. But it was, you know, again, you know, I mean, bimbo eruptions are one thing, but having, you know, I mean, come on. I mean,
what do you mean by that, Eric? What do you mean by that?
I mean, can you imagine what would have happened to you or me if those allegations had been made? And then three members of, you know, your church or my church or whatever, or even your job, any organization you were part of, got bumped off within a period of like 3 months. You know?
I think there would. I think first of all, by now we would know who this particular police officer is. We would know exactly who those phone calls were made to from the choir director. That person would probably be the target of ambush interviews. At the very least, we'd see pictures of them holding up their hands to the camera and saying they have no comment. Needless to say, it would have been pursued a lot more aggressively than this has been. Now, I've seen you on national television several times, and I haven't heard this particular story. Is this not the kind of question that you're being asked by the mainstream journalists?
Well, you know, most of the press that I'm on is what I would consider the alternative media. Fox News, you know, the conservative radio talk shows. You know, I was on CNN once when this thing first came out, and it was in the context of me and Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson and three other very hard left people, and it was, you know, kind of chaotic. After that, that was really pretty much all that I heard from what you would consider the mainstream press.
But they were interested in covering the story initially about the murders and whether or not they were tied to Barack Obama. CNN did give you that voice.
Well, you know, I haven't really been asked very much about that, and I don't know if it's because they find other aspects of the story, of my, you know, my story or my coverage more interesting, or if we just don't get to talk for very long, or if for some reason they're avoiding it. You know, there are a lot of folks, even among conservative commentators, who don't really like to look at those aspects that we don't really have a lot of proof for. You know, I mean, the odious actions that Obama's taken as president are quite, you know, quite upfront, quite prominent, quite obvious, and it might be that they want to address those instead. As far as what their, you know, their motivations are for not wanting to, you know, look at that are anyone's guess.
Well, absolutely. It just seems odd to me that we have a president that could be a sitting president that could be tied to three murders, and whether he had knowledge of it or whether or not someone who had a vested interest in seeing him get elected took matters into their own hand, it's still a huge story. I mean, whether he had personal knowledge that it was going to take place or not, you know, certainly there are huge huge amounts of money at stake anytime a president gets elected. There are always winners and losers, and it's certainly possible that someone that didn't want to be a loser wanted to make sure that their candidate got into office. And I'm certainly not suggesting it at all that you know, Barack Obama planned these murders or that Barack Obama had knowledge of these murders, but that somewhere someone who benefited from him being elected could be involved. And as we learned from the Nixon, as we learned from the Nixon Watergate case, you know, not having prior knowledge of it isn't always enough to get you off the hook. But
no,
if
indeed there was something untoward and these murders had been political, it's altogether possible that Obama himself had no knowledge of it, even to this day. However, my point is that, you know, that kind of baggage for any other candidate would have been just, you know, it would have been up in the front. We would have known about it. It would have been all over the national media, and the candidacy probably would not have survived that 2007.
Wow. Well, now, in your book, you make a reference to Barack Obama being groomed to run for the presidency. Groomed by whom?
Well, it's pretty much a matter of public record that billionaire financier and former Nazi collaborator George Soros has put a lot of organization and money and effort into Barack Obama's candidacy and organizations that support him and the far left and his vision of a, you know, open society, whatever sickness he wants to do. And there are a lot of, well, not a lot, but there are some key people like him who got behind Obama, obviously have been working toward this new world order, if you will, for years. And it is my belief, and I discuss this in the book, that given these negrophiliac sensibilities and the white guilt and everything else that goes with that, the aspect of that worldview, these people envisioned Obama as being one of the most handy people to bring us that much closer to this sort of system change paradigm we have going on in the United States, as far as us moving exponentially farther to the left. And you can see
now, is that because a white America suffering from guilt over slavery would allow a black president more latitude?
Absolutely. And you can see that since Obama got in, we have made that exponential and very aggressive move farther to the left. Case in point, you know, anyone who says anything in disagreement with him or his policies, they're hammered as a racist. Those are those very same sensibilities that people are using in order to assuage criticism of him are the very same things that helped to get him elected.
Let's talk about those accusations of racism, because there are some that have taken place in recent memory that really, really seem to be indicative of the left reaching and, as you said, you know, looking for Klansmen under every bush. Newt Gingrich responding to the video piece of Barack Obama making a three-point shot said that essentially we need a president who's not an athlete, but one who's going to instead address the issue of the economy, and he was immediately branded a racist. And we had an issue where, you know, of course, Rand Paul made the comment that he doesn't believe government should ever tell individual businesses what to do, so he probably would not have voted for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but he made it clear that he hates racism and he certainly would never take steps to repeal that, and that his answer about the Civil Rights Act of 1964 really had nothing to do with race, but instead about government power over the people. Yet he's been branded a racist in recent times. For again, a remark that I did not think was that serious. And yet I see liberal after liberal after liberal, Eric, making comments for which their conservative counterpart would be fried. Let me give you a few examples. And you and I are about a year and a half apart in age, so I know you're going to remember this. Back in 1980, Mike Wallace was grilling a banker about the number of minorities who had their homes foreclosed upon because of their failure to meet their obligation with home improvement loans. And the banker was trying to make the point that it was all spelled out in the contract. Well, they had to take a break to change out the film. And when Mike Wallace thought the cameras and the mics were safely off, he made the comment, yeah, but these contracts are a little hard to read if you're reading them over the tacos or reading them over the watermelon. Now, when that became public because the banker was shrewd enough to have his people there with cameras and mics, and rather than apologize when this thing was over, Mike Wallace, what he really did, frankly, was bitch about the fact that they should have cut their mic and camera off whenever his people cut their mics and cameras off. Never really got an apology out of him. Now, can you imagine Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, Rush Limbaugh saying these loan contracts are a little hard to read over the tacos and over the watermelon?
Oh, absolutely. Liberals are, and I don't even think they are conscious of this because they are so, they believe their own lies so deeply and strongly. They don't really, they're racists. I mean, they are manifestly racist. And I say in the book, I have had many more experiences of overt racism from people who identify themselves as politically liberal than people who identify themselves as politically conservative. And you look at Jesse Jackson's Hymietown. and things Al Sharpton has said. Louis Farrakhan is kind of an extreme example because I think he's a whack job anyway. But some of these people who are mainstream, who are considered mainstream, they make these remarks on a regular basis. And they are things that, as you said, a prominent white politician or conservative commentator would be flayed alive if they were to say something like this. But it's okay.
Let me throw out a couple more examples because I'm having fun pointing out how racist the liberals are. We talked about Mike Wallace. He was on 60 Minutes. You know who one of his partners was, Dan Rather. And did you see the Chris Matthews clip where Chris Matthews was interviewing Dan Rather, and Dan Rather actually said that Barack Obama was not a good salesperson. In fact, he couldn't sell watermelons on the side of the road if he had the state troopers flagging down the traffic for him.
Yeah, that was...
And I'm sitting back, I'm looking at that, Eric, and then Matt Drudge puts a little thing on his website whenever Obama said he needed to know whose ass to kick, and he says Obama goes street, and the liberal media goes crazy that Matt Drudge is a racist because, he didn't mean street tough, he didn't mean street talk. They assumed that Matt Drudge must have meant street black, so they got offended. But Dan Rather, the liberal broadcasting icon, can make a watermelon remark, and the only thing we saw was Chris Matthews fall all over himself trying to cut him off.
Yeah, well, of course, then there was Chris Matthews' comment of he forgot Obama was black. Wasn't it?
Well, listen, man, when you've got those shivers going up your leg like Chris Matthews does, it's easy to forget something like that. You know, it goes on and on. It's not just liberal broadcasters, though, Eric. I mean, we see this coming out of Hollywood all the time. You know, Sandra Bernhard said that if Sarah Palin went to Manhattan, she was going to be gang raped by Sandra's black brothers, as if any time a group of black men see a see a white woman on the street, their first instinct is to gang rape her. I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous, and I don't think that Charlton Heston, were he still alive, or, you know, name your favorite conservative in Hollywood, there aren't that many of them, if any conservative in Hollywood had made that remark, people would have been absolutely all over it. But it was made by a liberal, so, hey, you know, no biggie.
No, and well, you're right. And, you know, conservatives typically, you know, they're not as quick to go into the gutter or into the toilet. I mean, Sandra Bernhard, I think, pretty much lives there, and so consequently, you're gonna get that kind of thing. But the racism and the condescension, you know, when you have that in your heart, it's really difficult for it not to come out sideways at some point in time. You know, you're going to reveal who you are one way or another. And it isn't surprising to me that these things happen on a regular basis. But, you know, once again, there is that, you know, incredible double standard that you see. And, you know, Harry, I mean, I could dredge up these things, as I'm sure you could, well, too, all day
long. I've got a hard drive full of them.
Yeah, I mean, Harry Reid's, you know, no trace of a Negro accent thing, and, you know, like...
Joe Biden?
Yeah.
Well, what was the exact line? Wait a minute. I love this. Joe Biden said that Barack Obama was America's first clean, good-looking, articulate black man. Now, does that mean that Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton are, you know, have bad hygiene, they're ugly, and they're inarticulate? What does that mean?
That's what that means.
I mean, he was a vice presidential candidate at the time. Now, could you imagine if Sarah Palin had said that Barack Obama was America's first clean, good-looking, articulate black man?
Yeah, they would have shot her out of a cannon. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, she was already hanged in effigy in West Hollywood, so I can't imagine what they would do to her if she had said that. But there just seems to be this incredible double standard. And, you know, my favorite example, though, goes back to the 60s when you and I were both little kids. And that, Eric, is the fact that LBJ was, in fact, the president who signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 into law. And if you read the book, The President's Secret Service, the Secret Service detail assigned to him said the N-word was his favorite word.
Yeah.
So that makes you wonder if this is what the guy has in his heart, if he's spouting the N-word all the time, and yet he pushed for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, what was his ulterior motive? I mean, my guess is, can we all say voting block? I mean,
I mean, he was a politician, and he saw the way the country was moving, as was Robert Byrd, by the way. So, you know, that was more important to him than coming out as a segregationist. You know, once again, you are no doubt aware of the fact that the Democrats more so pushed for, keeping segregation, Jim Crow, all of that in place, and it was, you know, folks like the Kennedys who were sort of the black sheep, no pun intended, if you will, in the Democrat Party, because they were pro-integrationists, but, you know, they had to fight their party. The Democrat Party capitalized on that a great deal during the Civil Rights Movement in doing their PR fancy footwork in making the Democrat Party the party of civil rights and of the underdog and all of that, when heretofore they had been known as the party of slavery and segregation.
Absolutely. In fact, I know a gentleman very intelligent who absolutely goes ballistic anytime anyone suggests that it's the Republicans who are racist. He said, all you got to do is look at your history book. Well, not your history book. Those have been pretty much scrubbed. But if you can find accurate books on history, you'll see who the true racists were. Now, I almost think, Eric, that you're on some sort of a quest to replace Bill Cosby as the black American most hated by black America.
One would think so. Yeah.
Yeah, one would think so. The reason I say that is you use the term poverty pimps in your book, and you don't actually attach it directly beside the names of Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, but I had an idea that that might be the two gentlemen you were talking about. Were you, in fact, referring to them, and what is a poverty pimp?
Well, absolutely I'm referring to them, and there's dozens of other ones who are less prominent, but it's, the career civil rights activist for whom it is a monetary and career imperative to perpetuate the myth of black victimization. I mean, all of the social ills that afflict the black community, many of which have come about since the civil rights movement, can be traced directly to progressives. And these guys are the ones who, espouse this culture of victimization, yet they're the ones who have gotten wealthy off of keeping black Americans tied over a barrel with their pants around their ankles.
We've got to talk about that, because obviously we all remember on American Idol that the civil rights activist came forward and sang the song Pants on the Ground. It was an immediate YouTube sensation. But in your book, and I did not know this until I read your book, you explain where that fad or that fashion statement of wearing your pants around your ankles came from. Would you mind sharing that with our audience?
Oh, absolutely. All of the kids who are walking around wearing their loose pants with the waistbands around their behinds, that is prison chic. That is in the penitentiary. That identifies a submissive, if you will, to their dominant sexual partner. You know, if you have that, if you wear your pants like that, you're another inmate's property. And I could
go. Perhaps in more common terms, you are a prison bitch.
They're butt boy or whatever you want to, Yeah, that's it. And so all these kids are walking around, and, it came out of the black, urban black, style, I suppose, but obviously it spread everywhere. Among the youth, and all these kids are walking around looking like that, and they have no idea. I hope they have no idea where it came from.
So I'm guessing that what originally happened is that there was one guy who was the dominant male, and the other guy was getting released on parole, and he said, "Hey, just because you're out doesn't mean you're not going to still be my bitch. I need you wearing those pants around your ankles." Other people saw it; they thought it was stylish. It spread, and now you've got all these people running around advertising themselves as a prison bitch when, and they have no idea what the signal they're sending off.
I suppose that's as likely a possibility as any other.
I don't know why it was important to me to explore that, but I had to know. give me one quick second. We have to pause for station identification, and we will be right back.
You're listening to WGRV in Flatonia, Texas, the flagship station of the Tea Party Power Hour.
All right, we're back with Eric Rush, the author of Negrophilia, having a very informative conversation about sexual fashion in prison, among other things. Now, I'd like to ask you about the types of criticisms that I suspect are being thrown and slung at you right now, because Sean Hannity, I saw, obviously Sean thinks a lot of you. You're all over the first chapter of his book, Conservative Victory, and Sean had you on the show, and he said, "Eric, you are stepping into the fire."
Yeah.
Have you stepped into the fire? Tell us what you're facing right now.
Oh, yeah. I saw Sean in Salt Lake City back in March, and I told him about the book because he didn't know I was about to release it. And he asked me what the title was. When I told him the title, he let out one of those, low whistles, like, "Are you sure you're ready for this?" And in the introduction or the foreword of the book, I have you know, sort of a list of short, you know, short list of names of things that I typically get called on a regular basis by, you know, some black Americans, white liberals who think that, you know, who just don't like me because I don't buy into the orthodoxy of progressive race relations, race politics, or what have you. And, you know, Oreo, Uncle Tom, sellout, black white boy, bitch, you know, this, that, you know, this and that sucking mother, you know, effing, you know, I mean, everything.
Does the term house Negro come up?
Oh, all the time. That's a mild one. That's a mild one. You know, I mean, there's some people who have, you know, I don't quite understand some of the people who have that kind of mentality, yet they'll sit and watch an entire hour of Hannity's show. And say, don't you have something, you know, don't you have something else you could be doing with your time? I mean, if you don't like us that much, I can't imagine somebody that I dislike that intensely sitting and watching them on television for an entire hour. I guess
Eric, we've gotten an email in from a listener, and the listener would like to ask you. This actually comes from Chuck G. in Texas, and Chuck would like to ask you, Eric, what do you think about the fact that the societal standard is black people can use the N-word, but white people cannot?
I think it's a double standard. I think that it's a sort of a subtle form of the racism that I describe in the book. You know, if it's offensive, I don't understand why it should be acceptable for certain people to use it and others not. Now, I understand why it is, because you have these sort of racist sensibilities that I talk about during the whole book, but you know, you don't typically hear polite people of any particular ethnic group using the racial slur that pertains to their ethnic group. In polite conversation, they just normally don't do it. I mean, some people who, you know, more or less live in the gutter do that. But among blacks, it's very typical, or rather it's very accepted. Now, that has to do with something that I believe has also been advanced by the hard left, and that is to advance the most odious aspects of what they like to call black culture. For example, you know, there are forms of music that have come out of the black community that are not offensive and destructive like gangster rap music is, but that has been made into a mega industry. Why? Well, because the progressives and those who want to keep black people in ignorance and in, you know, squalor believe that that's an ideal way to do it, to promote an entire culture around this gangster rap that is disgusting, you know, misogynistic and anti-law enforcement and anti-education and anti-anything else positive that you can think of. So that is, you know, one of that, you know, you don't see, for example, other less attractive aspects of other ethnic groups being glorified the way you do that aspect and other aspects of black culture. And it really is because these politicians, activists, and so forth want to keep as many. They've had control of black Americans for a long, long time, and they want to keep it that way. And they have had a greater control over them than any other group, and they want to keep it that way. Consequently, you know, things like calling each other the N-word are going to be deemed as acceptable because it perpetuates that sort of gutter medium. You know, I mean, we're supposed to believe that most black Americans are inarticulate and do have sex on their minds all the time and want to rape white women and listen and hate the police and like big butts and all this other stuff.
I do remember that rap song. And again, you keep throwing things out that tell me that the two of us are about the same age, including your reference to Don Rickles and Buddy Hackett.
In your book.
Well,
yeah, they couldn't
now,
make it these days.
And you also pointed out that the movie Blazing Saddles couldn't be made today.
Yep. You know, they edit the hell out of that thing now on, when they put it on TV. Oh, yeah.
I haven't even noticed it. I haven't seen that movie in years, but it wouldn't surprise me at all that they would do that.
Yeah, I think it's about 5 minutes long now when they put it on television.
That'd be about all that's left of that, I guess. Now, one of the things that you mentioned in your book, and I found this very interesting, is that as far as white people and accusing white people of racism, the burden of proof is somewhat different. It's not beyond a shadow of a doubt or beyond a reasonable doubt, as they say now, or by a preponderance of the evidence like we see in civil court. But instead, it's like the Salem witch trials. The burden is on the white individual to prove they're not a racist. Expand on that a little bit.
Well, it's, you know, part and parcel of negrophilia. I mean, if you say that you don't like Barack Obama's ties or you think his hair's too short, you're branded a racist. You know, if you're a store clerk and you shortchange a black customer by mistake, it's racism and you have to, you know, jump through your behind to prove that you're not. And, I mean, a whole host of other types of, you know, anecdotal, examples that could be used. But once you're called a racist or it's suggested, the onus is upon you to prove that you're not. And that is conditioning. And that is the reason that we have that conditioning. And, you know, all goes back to the same motivation for negrophilia in the first place. And that is to garner political power for the left. But the reason, the conditioning has been extremely, you know, potent. The reason being that, you know, we still have a white majority. We had an even bigger white majority in 1965. Now, you know, you have to go to great efforts to make sure that majority is in control. Consequently, that white guilt had to be cultivated over a long period of time. And, you know, you have now a couple of generations who have been raised in it, and, you know, their point of view is, you know, anything but racist, you know. And call me anything, but, you know, call me a bull buggerer, call me a child molester, anything but racist. And so it's become very conditioned, Pavlovian almost, to accept that. If you're white and someone calls you a racist, other than saying, I'm not a racist, get out of my face.
Mm. Well, I think it's interesting that you brought up the situation with Disney and the movie The Princess and the Frog, because you suggested that no matter what a major corporation will try to do to make the African-American community happy, it seems like it's never good enough.
Yes, it's not good enough because the activists have, they continue to deliver the message to black Americans that nothing will ever be good enough. You know, until every black American is driving around in a Lamborghini and has as many millions of dollars to throw into the fireplace as they want, then it's not going to be good enough. And that isn't something that originates among blacks themselves. It originates among the activists who have that, you know, economic imperative once again. And they have essentially traded in their honor for a seat at progressives' table, whereby they get money and political power and get to, their ego boost or whatever, whatever they're getting out of it. That's self-seeking and self-serving and all of that. And then once again, that is just another human failing that a lot of us have. In this case, they happen to be black. I don't know, if you want to go into the argument or the concept of are they worse than anyone else because they're selling out, quote-unquote, their own people, I don't know. I just think that it's kind of ironic and amusing in sort of a sad way that so many black folks want to call me a Quisling and a race traitor and all of this. And when you have the king of them up there in Jesse Jackson, who is practically worshipped, yet he is, again, the first and foremost race-baiting, poverty pimp sellout that I can think of.
Well, let's say this. There's been a lot of selling out lately. I mean, for instance, the AARP initially jumped on board with the health care plan, even though the AARP members did not want it. By the way, I just turned 47, and they won't stop sending me junk mail. We know you're not 50 yet, but please, you're almost there. and then we had the American Medical Association jump on board the health care plan, and when the vast majority of doctors were against it. So people at the top, considered leaders, selling out their membership is hardly anything exclusive to the black community. I think
that's human nature. That's a left thing. That's a far left thing, and it's what they do. Unfortunately, unless you are the kind of news savvy person who's going to do their own research, and most people aren't, the establishment press is going to get out there, and Katie Couric is going to get out there and say, well, most people want the health care reform. Most AARP members want this. Most doctors want this. And it's a bald-faced lie, but most people come away thinking, oh, wow, well, I guess it's true because Katie said it.
I have close ties to the medical community, and I can assure you that doctors did not want this. Now, one thing we want to make clear is that because of your opinions now does not mean that you don't agree that at one time there was very much a need for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and at one point racism was very, very strong in America. I mean, you're not denying the history. You're just suggesting it's time to move on.
Correct. And, I know that that same sort of bigotry still exists but not to the degree, and it's definitely not institutional. I mean, I had some pretty scary experiences growing up, certainly scarier than any 20 or 30-year-old black man these days has had. Yet, you've got, young black multimillionaires like Kanye West, who is a dunce, standing up there and people are paying him all the deference of, a university professor when he talks about, Bush hating black people and this is a racist nation and all that other garbage. It's a matter of, I've seen the changes that have gone on. I applaud the positive ones, but there have been some really negative ones, and some of them have disproportionately affected the black community, which could be in far better shape than it is. And the only reason for it is because they have aligned themselves with the political left. And, obviously because of the political left being who they are, I'm going to be targeted as, whatever it is I'm targeted as. But, absolutely. I go over that kind of stuff in the book. And reasonable people will read that, and then they'll see that that's where I'm coming from. Obviously, your left, a far left ideologue, they're lost already. We're never going to convince them.
I guess our only hope is the people in the middle, the independents, because you're right, the far left people just don't get it. You can talk to them until they're blue in the face. Denial is a big part of what goes on there. I mean, there are liberals who will tell you that, Jesse Jackson never said Hymietown. He wouldn't have said something like that. I know he wouldn't have said something like that. Mm-hmm. And, most of the kids these days are getting their news from Comedy Central and Saturday Night Live. So yeah. I've been tempted to put a YouTube clip out there of Eddie Murphy making fun of the Hymietown joke back in 1984 just to prove to these kids that it actually happened, because they'll go, oh, it was on Saturday Night Live. It must be true.
Yeah. that's probably a great idea.
Yeah. So now another thing you point out in the book is that the media and the academic system begin inculcating Negrophilia at a very early age. It's something that's in the schools, it's in the entertainment that reaches the young people. Whenever I read that in your book, one of the first things that came to mind, you know, it's funny we talk about The Princess and the Frog, but if you take a look at a movie like, say, Pocahontas, where she opens the song Colors of the Wind by saying, "You think I'm an ignorant savage," and then at one point in the song, in reference to white people, says the line, "You think the only people who are people are the people who look and think like you." Right. I mean, this is a show aimed at kids, and it's not exactly painting white people in a favorable light.
No, no. And, you know, there are other ways to get across the idea that the explorers, English settlers back then were... I guess if you want to say bigoted, or who were, looking for fortune and glory and all of that, and certain things they did are wrong, without painting all whites with that broad brush. But that's what Negrophilia is about. It's about painting all whites with that broad brush. I mean, that's why you have so many. Black young people who are even more cynical and jaded and mistrustful than they were in 1965. But you can go into the schools, of course, now, and you see that same kind of thing going on. It is, as you said, it starts really young, and it's in the schools, it's in the entertainment, it's in the press. Non-whites, noble, gentle, spiritual, honorable whites, evil, duplicitous, avaricious. All of that, and then that's what they were raised believing.
I would have to say that it must start at a very young age, because I know a gentleman who said that he was witnessing a fire engine in a predominantly African American part of town trying to put out a fire in the home of a black family. And young African American children were throwing rocks at the flashing lights of the fire engine. And when he inquired as to what was going on, one of the firemen said, "Well, it's unfortunate, but the young African American children in this neighborhood tend to associate these lights with the police, and they associate the police with racism."
So this must start
at a very early age.
Yeah, I wrote about this in a column. I have a friend who was a firefighter in Chicago, and he'd go into these same black neighborhoods, and it is appalling the stories I've heard from this man. I mean, they used to set fires so the firemen would come, and then they'd shoot at them. They would booby trap the burning buildings. Because they associated anyone with a uniform, anyone in authority, as, in quotes, the man, and they deserved what they got. And it didn't matter even if the firefighters were black. I mean, that's how angry these people were. And this is back, in the 60s, 70s, early 80s, and so this has only gotten worse.
I don't understand it. I mean, frankly, I don't get it. There's a group of firemen trying to save the home of an African American family,
yep.
And these kids are throwing rocks at them. It's reminiscent of the helicopters bringing aid to New Orleans during Katrina, only to be shot at. It's amazing. Eric, we are almost out of time. Please tell us how the listeners can get a hold of your book, because I know they're going to want to read it.
Okay, you can get my book. There are links to it on my website, ericrush.com. That's ericrush.com. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or you can get autographed copies at the WorldNet Daily Superstore.
Wow. Hey, I'd like one of those. And let me tell you that you can also get it right now for anyone who's actually listening to the show online through Blog Talk Radio. I've got both your books posted there, Eric. I have
awesome.
Negrophilia as well as Annexing Mexico, which will be another story for another day. I don't think we got three chapters into your book, so I'm hoping that you enjoyed this. I'm hoping you enjoyed the experience enough that you'd be willing to come back and let us
absolutely.
Get even deeper. into your book, because I thoroughly enjoyed having you here today. Not to brag on either one of us, but I think this is one of the more frank conversations about race that I've ever seen go out over the airwaves. And
yeah,
I'd like to continue that. You said on Sean Hannity that you hoped your book would be the beginning of a genuine dialogue on race in this country, and I hope we've sort of got the ball rolling on that today. I'd like to continue it, and I'm hoping that others will follow the example.
I would love to.
Fantastic. We're down to 20 seconds, so Eric, I will just thank you for being here today. I will encourage everyone listening to the show today to buy a copy of Eric's book. You will not be able to put it down, and we'll have Eric back again soon. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you. Have a good one. Happy 4th.
You too.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.